Hi, everyone. This is Louis DeLucia from Ice Miller. I'm just going to welcome everyone for now, but we will hold for just a minute or two to allow people to join. We had over 100 additional registrants for this so far, so we only have 85 or 86, but people are joining. So we'll wait a minute or two before we begin to give them some time to log in. So bear with us. Thank you so much. All right, why don't we begin, and hopefully others will join. As I mentioned, my name is Louis DeLucia of Ice Miller. Ice Miller represents the official committee of unsecured creditors in the National Realty Investment Advisors cases. Also with me is Michael Ott and others from Ice Miller as well. And we also have on the call Alvarez and Marcel, who are financial advisors to the committee, and have been actively involved in working with the debtors in connection with assets, real estate, investigation, and other aspects of the bankruptcy case as we have. But again, this is a series of town halls. We've been continuing them since soon after the petition date, but we're trying to keep obviously investors and creditors informed on what is going on in the bankruptcy case. So let me recap where we are, give you a little bit of a summary of what the general aspects of what's happening in the case as we sit here today, where we anticipate going in the near future, the status of some of the real estate, budget, and investigation issues will also be covered by Alvarez and Marcel, who are on this call as well. So let's start with where we are since we last spoke in, I think, December, the last town hall. And since then, the claims bar date has passed. We've had a substantial number of claims filed. We have not, of course, poured through those claims yet. They are going to be part of a claims reconciliation process in this case, which will take some time. Also on the call, by the way, as you know, is Allison Fiedler, and I believe Dan Polacek from Ice Miller as well. So that claims process is going to be a substantial claims process. It will be in a number of months. It will not be now. It will be part of the process of vetting duplicative and other claims that might be disallowable as a matter of bankruptcy or other law. But to give you a quick summary of an example of why that process will be substantial, more than, according to the Omni docket, and this is only according to the Omni docket, 5,719 claims were filed. There aren't 5,719 investors or creditors. $2.8 billion in unsecured debt. There weren't that many investors. $1.4 billion of which is secured, and $2.5 million of priority claims under 503b9. So that's just a quick summary of what the claims look like on Omni's website. That is not directly reconciled with the debtor's records or our records based upon the investigation so far. So there's going to be a lot of reconciliation between what was filed by people and entities and what the records of the investigation and the company reflect. So those numbers will be adjusted. Those are not numbers you should rely on in any way for statements that that's what the claims are, because those are probably include duplicative claims where multiple claims are filed by individuals, etc. But that's something that's happened since we last spoke, but also is going to be part of the process going forward in the analysis of claims. We've been working with the debtors, the committee has, on your behalf in connection with drafting plan and disclosure statements. The disclosure statement, which is the document that discloses to the investors and creditors of what the plan is going to do and provide, is in draft. The plan is also in draft. A draft plan has been drafted. But there are substantial legal issues that we are working with the debtors and their advisors and our advisors, Alvarez and Marcel, to come to a plan that is the most fair, equitable, and maximizes the return to investors and creditors. There are substantial legal issues that include whether or not these estates of over 130 entities should be consolidated into one, whether or not they should be treated separately, for example, the property operating entities versus the fund. And for those who don't know or don't recall the structure is essentially you have NRIA at the close to the top, the entity NRIA. Then you've got the fund, which is below that, and also both of them have ownership of membership of entities that own the property entities. So it's three-tiered at least, and you have the property entities below that are owning certain of the properties, developing certain of the properties. Then above that are the holdcos. Those holdcos are held by NRIA and the fund. So there are creditors at various levels of that, and an analysis that's being done is the best way to maximize the recovery for each of the categories of creditors in these tranches. It's not an easy task because there are various rights. Some are investors, some are creditors, some, as a matter of law, believe that they're creditors, but in fact are investors, etc. So there's an analysis that's going on forward that really has to be done in part, partially claim by claim, but largely structurally. So that analysis is ongoing. The objective is to file that plan and disclosure statement as soon as possible, so that we can get out of the bankruptcy and move on with lessen the costs of the bankruptcy and get towards a trust that will enable the case to move forward with development and or sale of certain properties and the pursuit of further investigations and litigation. We would expect, and we're still targeting, a second quarter 2023 plan confirmation. That's the date by which the court would approve the plan. We're still targeting that. It's not a guarantee. We don't know court schedule. We don't know objections that could come in that could delay it. We don't know legal issues that could be suddenly arise. But right now, the target and objective is to meet that date. The efforts, as I mentioned, are into maximizing asset recoveries, both real estate and litigation and investigation based. We're going to get into the litigation and investigation in a little bit, but one thing we want to level set with you on the real estate side of things is that at the beginning of the case, we all saw Mr. Casey's representations. We saw some of the filings at the beginning of the case regarding real estate values. The real estate values have been really dug into by the CRO, by the company, has been vetted in part by Alvarez, and looked at the process that the CRO engaged in, which included retaining Otto as appraisers, the retention of broker opinions regarding the value of the various properties, and the prospect for maximizing value in all of those properties, some of which have been identified for development, some of which have been identified for sale, some of which have been identified for obtaining approvals and then sale, all of which are geared towards maximizing those recoveries. Nevertheless, those values on the real estate side do not appear to be sufficient in amount to cover what we believe the investor claims are. That means that there will likely be litigation recoveries necessary to make up that difference. Those litigation recoveries are substantial in terms of what will have to be done. We don't know what the actual outcome will be, but there are substantial claims, and we'll get into those in a minute. But like I mentioned, the Otto Group was retained, appraisals were obtained, real estate Broker opinions were obtained, and we will have to make up any shortfalls on real estate based upon current understandings on litigation and recovery. So before we get to the litigation, I'll turn over the real estate part of this discussion to Alvarez, as they've done in the past, to give us a quick summary of real estate lay of the land, literally, right now.
Thanks, Lewis. Good afternoon, all. And just picking up from where Lewis was guiding us in terms of the real estate update, it is true we are currently in receipt of the strategy that the CRO, the debtor CRO, has provided. And we are reviewing on a property-by-property basis the merits against the scenarios that the CRO is proposing. Meaning, should we sell a particular property in the as-is condition? Should we obtain approvals, which will likely provide incremental value? Or in some cases, should we look at developing certain ongoing projects to again achieve incremental value over what they might trade at today? And versus the final scenario, which is around what if we were able to put some income within some of these assets that are post-completion and will be in a better spot to exit from a value standpoint. So all of those points are being reviewed. The key components have been the appraisals that we have been receiving since December of last year, as well as the broker opinion of values and the local market. We are currently aggregating those cash flows, and as Lewis pointed out, those are materially lower than the face value of the claim. But we are continuing to conduct our analysis on the numbers. I do also want to share an update in terms of the units that have been closed. So in the portfolio outside of the real estate assets that are under construction or in pre-development, there have been some condominiums that have either closed or are on the docket to close. So quick recap on that. There have been about 4 units closed, which are funds in escrow, approximately $7.7 million net. In addition, there are 3 additional units that are currently on the docket but have not closed yet. And those are approximately $8.8 million expected net sale proceeds. And then finally, there are additional 10 units deemed condominiums that are not on the docket but are being marketed for sale over the coming months. And that in estimate right now is about a $17 million net cash flow coming back. So those would be added back to the face value that was being discussed, and we should have a consolidated view in the coming weeks from a real estate standpoint. So I know there was a question also, should we address that now or should we wait for the list of questions to go back?
Let's go through the questions when we get to them at the end. We'll go through those questions one by one. So thanks, Amir, very much.
Okay, great.
Yes, so I should say that we did receive a number of questions from investors, and we appreciate that. So we will be going through those. Don't think that our summary is skipping those. We will be going through them. All right, so let's go ahead and go to the investigation now. Let me give you a quick summary of that, then I'll turn it over to Alvarez again. In terms of the investigation, what the committee's been doing is been focusing heavily on those individuals and entities culpable to the estate and creditors and investors in connection with the pre-petition securities fraud as well as related misconduct. We've also been working on developing those theories and causes of action that would maximize those recoveries. And we have developed a number of buckets or targets that we anticipate pursuing, but also the legal theories surrounding those. What is being developed is essentially the infrastructure around those claims, meaning the information, the facts, because there's so much data coming in pursuant to our discovery. And I'll get into that in a second. So the legal theories and recovery actions are being developed. They're also we're also looking at traditional Chapter 5, what are called avoidance or fraudulent conveyance or transfer claims by the estate for funds that were transferred to third parties that were inappropriately transferred. Those are being examined. We've identified assets and are pursuing identifying assets for eventual recovery from those third parties. So by way of example, a judgment was obtained on a smaller claim against Gravato and Salzano, two of the principals of the debtor. And the committee aided by providing, as a result of the research done by the committee's investigators, Alvarez and others, and Richard Barry and Associates, those investigators as well. We transferred that information over to the debtors to collect that judgment against Gravato assets, like a property, residential property owned by Gravato, so that that judgment could be collected against that asset to transfer it to cash for you. So that's the objective of developing those tracing of assets. We've also attempted to make sure that we obtain documents and testimonial evidence. We haven't gotten to depositions yet, but they're coming up. But the documents needed that are presently available so that they don't get destroyed years from now, or don't get lost from years from now, or misplaced or diverted years from now, so that we have these documents to support the claims when they're eventually brought. So let me tell you about that. We've issued more than 94 subpoenas and served more than all of them. Some may have not been successful in service because, for example, they are hiding or out of the country. But we have otherwise served the bulk of those, including against banks, trust companies, accounting firms, individuals, and we are getting every day additional documents coming in. That is in addition to the more than 7 million documents that were provided to the government in connection with its investigation that we're reviewing. And from those documents, we have teams reviewing them, both at Alvarez and Ice Miller, to identify transactions that we believe give a basis for additional claims against third parties. For example, U.S. Construction is an entity that we're investigating heavily. We fought with them in court regarding discovery. We were successful in obtaining additional discovery from them. And that leads us to believe that there are additional claims against U.S. Construction and others in connection with that company related to the securities fraud and otherwise. So that's an example. We are teeing up depositions of U.S. Construction as well as its principals in the near future. In the next couple of weeks, we're hoping. And that those depositions will likely produce additional opportunity for recovery. Before I turn it over to Alvarez, let me give you a quick summary of the general areas, the targets, if you wish, that we are looking at, the buckets that we're looking at for recovery for you. In addition to the inner circle, so follow me with this, the inner circle being the big bad actors we all know, Salzano, Gravato, O'Brien, etc., people against whom indictments have already been brought, right? These inner circle people are obvious targets. They're assets are obvious targets to the extent they are in their name. What this team is doing is tracing and identifying where they've hid those assets for your benefit. That's what Alvarez is doing. That's what we're doing. That's what Richard Barry and Associates are doing. That's what we're doing. Those inner targets, inner circles, is one bucket. Another bucket is U.S. Construction. I just told you about that, about their relationship, about Dustin Salzano, the son of Thomas Nicholas Salzano, as the principal. That connection is obvious, but more importantly is the transactions between the two are being examined and appear to give rise to possible claims. And that's already been identified to the court as what we need to investigate through subpoenas. Next bulk of investigations areas is NRIA employees and promoters. People that you have spoken to who might have promoted sales to you, they may have culpability. Banks and financial institutions who ignored red flags as funds flowed around through investors to accounts, to other accounts of the NRA entities, to other accounts at U.S. Construction, etc. There are claims that often are brought against banks for missing red flags, know your customer claims, aiding and abetting, or facilitating money laundering, etc. Those claims are being examined. And what I mean by that is we've already subpoenaed many, many banks. And those subpoenas, TD Bank and others, are going to provide information. Alvarez will track that cash, and Bill Waldy will explain it in greater detail. They're going to track that cash, and they're going to follow the money. We have feeder funds. Those are people who got compensated for bringing other investors in, knowing, or for that matter, disregarding, that there might have been illegality in the sale of these securities. Promoters of the media, in the media. You've seen actions, perhaps you've followed some of the cryptocurrency litigation, but those kind of claims may not survive. But if they do, we're exploring them, and we're looking at claims against people like Fox, CNBC, or others that might have promoted or sold advertising, and whether or not those claims exist in connection with promoting the securities. Other law firms that might have activity that were involved in the sale of the securities that could have culpability. CPA firms, financial advisors and accountants to the company. And then, of course, your traditional property clawbacks. There may be some claims for those who benefited from the fraud through full redemptions many years ago that might have to be pursued, and other transfers that we're identifying. So I'll get into the causes of action after. I think I'll turn it over to Bill and the Alvarez team about even more granular information regarding the investigation. Then we'll talk about globally about the kind of causes of action we're going to bring against these people. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Lewis. All right, I'll try not to repeat some of the stuff you did, but I'll skip around here and I'll try to give you guys a good high-level overview of where we stand right now with the investigation. As you know, it's a complex $650 million fraud scheme. Our teams right now have ongoing research. That's global intelligence, business intelligence, and that's digging into each person, everything that they have out there, be it litigations, be it assets, real property, boats, whatever it may be, trying to dig financial accounts is ongoing. The document review that Lewis mentioned, which started at about 7 million documents from the government, it's now about 5.8 million because there were some duplicates in there that we were able to eliminate to keep this, more streamlined so we could get through this quicker. This is all done through keywords and targeted searches. So you're not actually looking at 5.8 million documents, but we're looking at them based on a strategy of keywords that we develop, based on schemes and leads that we find, the litigation support, and then the ongoing financial analysis. In order to do this, there was a ton of information that was dropped on us. So what we had to do is develop a proprietary QuickBooks database. QuickBooks is the operating system they use, because there was 122 debtor entities and over 240,000 lines of accounting records that we're going through as we're trying to figure this out, and we are figuring it out. We've developed, great institutional knowledge now, understanding all the players and the flow of funds. We've also leveraged our technology group to construct a database of over 180,000 bank transactions and 117 bank accounts where we're following the money. Lewis mentioned a little bit about the layering of funds. It's not just a bank account goes and buys a house or goes and buys whatever or goes to whatever bank account. A lot of times this money will move through three or four different accounts, three or four different shells, three or four different entities. So in order to figure that out, we've also constructed a matrix of over 300 individuals and entities. And we've done relationship mapping to the not only the key insiders like Salzano and Scaturo and those guys, but everything around them, not only their inner circle, but other contacts, people they'll deal with, businesses. And then we could follow the trail of funds based on those entities. We've also created family tree diagrams to build out so we know who all the relatives are, who the close associates are, who the businesses are, everything that's in contact in this circle. And that's to help us identify how the money's moving through the complex layering. As far as the subpoenas, 94 subpoenas have been served, as Lewis said. There's about 120 subpoenaed parties now that we find. That's constantly changing. We continuously find things where we need more records to bring them in. So again, we could follow the money. As far as the insiders go, just to date now in the business intelligence, and this is just the close group, we found about a little more than $10 million in real assets that they have tied to their names. That's not including other stuff that's going to be in other entity names as we continue to dig and find. That's just on the initial dig. Part of that research, you know, just at a high level involves, you know, court records, property records, corporate filings, social media, online news, various subscription databases that we do. And it's an iterative process where we go through to figure this out and find these things. As far as the causes of action, to me, that is the most important part. So identifying where we think the deepest pockets are and the best recoveries for you. And Lewis talked about some of these buckets, be it the financial institutions, financial service firms, and just as like examples, the Stanford Ponzi scheme just had a settlement in the last couple of weeks with one of the financial institutions, which was $100 million. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's the case in all of these, but there is real money out there, depending on some of those elements that Lewis already went through with you that, you know, I'm not going to repeat now, but those are the elements as we work with ICE from a legal standpoint, that as investigators, we look for that evidence through the document review and the analysis to put it together. And then we talk about, you know, the reputational management firms, the relationship managers, the sales leads, the feeder funds, the EB-5 funds, the insiders themselves, affiliated entities, their construction partners, professionals, accountants, law firms. Those are all the things we're keying on to see who helped this scheme run, because that's where you're going to find the money as we go through. But that's what I got right now, Lewis, as far as a high level goes. So
that's great. That's great.
I know there's a couple of questions too regarding the investigation and some fraud questions that we'll address when we get to the questions.
Terrific. Thank you, Bill. That's correct. We'll do that. Let me just take what Bill just summarized, which is the real nitty-gritty of the investigation, the details of the investigation, and what I summarized earlier about the 9 buckets that I identified of the target areas we're looking at for recovery. And let me give you what that translates into causes of action against these people, meaning lawsuits against them for the recovery of money. So in addition to fraudulent transfers, meaning monies that were transferred by the company to third parties, maybe Salzano diverted $100,000 to his niece because he just wants to hide money. That kind of information, that kind of transfer where it's a no value to the company, is your money as an investor, we will pursue those. Those are fraudulent transfers. And there are more complex, bigger fraudulent transfers that we're exploring as well. Breaches of fiduciary duty, lawsuits against the principals who had a duty to you as investors and creditors and to this estate who did not honor their duties. And those are the kind of claims that we'll bring against them as well as third parties who might have aided and abetted. That's like perhaps some of the accounting firms, perhaps some of the other officers, perhaps some of the contract parties with whom they did business that aided and abetted the fraud and the breach of fiduciary duty. Of course, conversion to the extent they diverted cash and took it for their personal benefit. Absolutely, of course, fraud, aiding and abetting that fraud. But in a bigger picture, what the real big claim will likely be civil RICO, both federal and state. And what we mean by that is what you've heard and seen in the movies. It's the Racketeering Influence and Corruption Act, or basically it's the claim that was used originally to go against the mafia, which was essentially pursuing the enterprise of an illegal, illicit business for the recovery of damages that can be treble, meaning 3 times the damages, from these individuals and entities. So the concept is Salzano, Scaturo, and all these folks up here were running the business. They, with others, perhaps hidden or in conjunction, collaborated as an enterprise to commit certain illegal acts, and those illegal acts translated into damages to you, and therefore you can pursue RICO claims against all of them as a joint actors causing damage to you. It's a very complex case. We have a number pending across the country against other entities right now, and but it would be a federal and state civil RICO claim against those entities. Of course, we'd also, to the extent any of these individuals or entities asserted claims against the company from which you would be sharing any recovery, we would seek to disallow those claims and subordinate those claims to your claims as defrauded investors and creditors. So those are the kind of causes of action, by no means limited, but those are the kind of causes of action, of course, based on the securities fraud and otherwise, that we would be pursuing and are in the process of developing. So that's a quick summary of what's going on. Case and negotiation regarding the plan, real estate, investigation, and as you can tell, with millions of pages of documents, over 100 subpoenas, in process and served, documents coming in on those, creating and finding all the dots showing where they hid the money, because you have $560 million or more of investors, and you don't have that much in real estate, according to the present values. So if you think about that, where'd the money go? And that's what we're finding. So let's turn to the questions so that we can address those. We try to keep these calls to as close to an hour as possible for people to go on with their lives. So let's start with the first one. And I know, Hamir, this is one you mentioned earlier that was within the real estate area. The first one is, I see that $3.725 million was paid by insurance company for the Fort Myers Marina. What is the plan for that property?
Great. Thanks, Louis. I can take that. So that is correct. So there is $3.75 million that has come back in insurance claims on that property. That is currently being held in escrow, and the escrow release is contingent upon the strategy that the CRO is putting in place for that particular asset. There are also various approvals that need to be secured as part of the strategy, which will allow for the debtors and the CRO to come up with an exit or a sale strategy upon receipt of the approvals, which will then incrementally increase value on the asset. That is the plan that we are aware of currently. So collectively, the $3.7 million, which is in escrow, and the sale proceeds once concluded will come back, is our expectation, to the entity, and will be a part of the aggregate cash flow from the real estate.
Thank you, Hamir. Next question is investigation related. I won't use this individual's name, but the question is this salesperson complicit in this fraud? And I will answer that generally. And of course, Bill, if you want to add on, feel free to do so. We are in amongst the buckets that I mentioned are the employees, if you remember, I said that. Employees who aided and abetted. We're not saying they're liable. We're not saying we've come to an adjudication of that. We're saying we are investigating and we believe that there may be legal theories and substantial cash that went to these individuals that give rise to causes of action that may enable us to recover funds for you because they either knew or disregarded and benefited from the fraud, and therefore that recovery should come back for your benefit. So what we're saying is, yes, the salespeople, the people that promoted the securities are part of our target base. Unquestionably. And I'm not talking about we're just beginning to look at it. We have been looking at it. We have memos on it. We've researched it, the legal issues. We're tracking the money, seeing how much that is. And eventually that may very well be a cause of action. Ray Gerbato is a fugitive. Will his assets be seized? I think you've already heard from Bill that some of the assets have been identified. But Bill, if you want to jump in on that, feel free to do so.
The answer on that would be yes. Anything that we find related to Ray Gerbato or anybody else out there, there are assets we have found connected to him, both here in the U.S. and also There are, although we're still trying to tie down the exacts, is assets in the Philippines as well.
Terrific. Thanks, Bill. Next are tax questions. Status of K-1s and any other tax-related documents for filing income tax personally. The answer to that is, I'll read all three because quite frankly, they're combined. Should we be anticipating K-1s for 2022? If so, when? And will K-1s for 22 be on time? This committee has no control over the K-1s. This committee is representative of the investors and creditors for the very same things we just talked about. K-1s are prepared internally for and on behalf of the company, by the company and its advisors, Eisner Amper, as well as the company employees themselves. We have reached out. I don't know if Andrea, if you have any further update, but we have reached out to company management to find out when and if there will be any timing on that. But go ahead, Andrea.
Yes, thank you, Lewis. I did reach out, as Lewis mentioned, but unfortunately we did not hear before this meeting. So we'll advise if we hear otherwise. But right now we have no reason to believe that they won't be issued on time, but we'll keep you apprised.
Thank you, Andrea. So the answer to that, you know, more generally is we're aware of the issue, and even though it's not within our gambit of, you know, our bucket of authority or duty, we nevertheless care, and so we will be speaking to the company and its principals about seeing that those K-1s get processed if we can. Next, fraud questions. Ponzi schemes are tax deductible as theft loss. Is NRIA considered a Ponzi scheme? You know, we had a call about this meeting today internally before this call, and it was actually one of the most interesting questions, because we can't give you tax advice as a theft loss or otherwise. So that's one of those third rails that advisors don't go down the road of advising people of tax advice without knowing their full financial and tax exposure. So no tax advice on that. However, is NRIA considered a Ponzi scheme? And I think we can safely say, and Bill would probably say, that it's already in the indictments against the individuals by the federal government, DOJ, that this is a Ponzi scheme. But Bill, go ahead.
I agree with what you're saying. It is a Ponzi-like scheme, you know, fraud scheme, but yes, Ponzi scheme. And it is in the indictment of both Nick Salzano and Ray Gravano. So the government's saying the same thing.
Bill, why don't you take the next question too, which is, I've received information that NRIA was just a classic Ponzi scheme. If that is the case, then how is it that they had salaried personnel?
A Ponzi scheme doesn't always start out as a Ponzi scheme in all situations. There's salaried employees have nothing to do with that. Many of them start out as legitimate businesses, get underwater, and they start to do things, and next thing you know, it becomes a full fraud or a Ponzi scheme. But you'll see a lot of these, if you go back and you look at ones that are now public, look at Madoff. Madoff had two businesses. One ran on one floor, one ran on another floor. One was a legitimate front. The other was running the Ponzi. But they started feeding into the legitimate company too. But even the illegit company still had salaried employees. So just because something purports to be a legitimate business and pays its employees or has 1099 independent contractors or W-2s, don't let that be your guide as to whether this is legit or not. This is a fraud scheme run like a business. And then typically what happens, they get out of control, they get underwater, they can't keep up with the redemptions. And then we're in this unfortunate situation.
Thank you, Bill. All right, next is, can individual investors retain Ice Miller to represent us individually in this case? Regrettably, no. The law prohibits us from representing a fiduciary like the committee and any individual investor at the same time during the same case. We could represent individuals in other matters, but regrettably not this case. Do we have a ballpark estimate of how much attorney fees will cost to conclusion of the Chapter 11? We know it's expensive. We know that we're doing everything we can to work with the company, its board, to be as efficient as possible. As concerns are raised, we make sure that the fees are pared back. There is a fee examiner appointed by the court that oversees and makes sure that as a matter of law, that our fees comport with the bankruptcy law and are reasonable and compensable. That fee examiner is not appointed by us, is appointed by the U.S. trustee. And the budget that was filed at docket number 1938 is on the docket. You can see the budget that has some idea of the actual cash budget. Andrea, I don't know if you want to address that at all, but that is on the docket for available review on that issue. Next, recovery plan claims. What has been done since your last creditors committee town hall to progress this case towards resolution? I've addressed that, I believe. Next question. Can I expect to at the very least, to recover the amount that is reflected on debtor schedules of assets and liabilities? The amount of any recovery right now is unknown for sure. And the reason I say that is because we told you about the real estate, and the balance of any recovery will have to come from litigation and other recoveries. So we're not certain of the amount of recovery. We hope for, as one question on the side that was posted during this meeting, we continue to strive for 100% recovery. Our goal is 100% recovery, but we don't always recover that, but that certainly is our goal. Date of restoring normal distribution. There is no normal distribution that will be restored. This company is going to be going through its bankruptcy process. It will be effectively restructured, and you put quotes around that restructuring in the sense that assets will likely be transferred to either a trust or an entity held by the trust post-bankruptcy. The properties will be sold and or developed and then sold so that you get the money. And then the company will not likely continue. But it will not be dissolved at confirmation. That's the current plan. The current plan is the company will not be dissolved at confirmation. There's a number of legal reasons for that. What is the timeline for resolution of this bankruptcy? As I mentioned, there are going to be two parts of this case, okay? The first part is the Chapter 11 we're in the middle of right now. Plan confirmation, meaning the approval of the plan, which I mentioned I hope to be in the second quarter of 2023, will be the end of the Chapter 11 globally, in the sense that the 11 is confirmed and approved by the court, the plan. But then a trust goes on, and that trust is for your benefit, and it's to transfer these assets, liquidate these assets, recover the assets, recover the litigation claims for your benefit. That could take years because of the need to sell, some of them may be developed, and also to recover against the bad actors. So technically, the bankruptcy, Chapter 11, may end soon, but the balance of the case on recoveries will be far later. When will funds be available for repayment to me? As I mentioned, distributions will be only made at or about confirmation or soon thereafter, depending upon what funds are available and what the plan can provide. That process is, as I mentioned, being worked on, and whether or not an initial distribution can be made at confirmation is uncertain, but certainly the hope is that there could be some. And then thereafter, obviously distributions as properties are sold and interim distributions thereafter as assets are recovered. When we will have a plan, when will we exit bankruptcy? All questions I've answered. Would like to know the CRO latest state of union and his restructuring plan. I think we just addressed that with Hamir's summary of the real estate, the sales, and the fact that we have a presentation actually with and a meeting with the CRO on Monday the 13th at 5 p.m. We have with the committee, and we'll be walking through his real estate plan in detail, all as part of the plan development. Can you summarize the total money NRA has and what is the current income and expenses of NRAA? There are two sources of that. Obviously there are 130 plus debtors, each filing monthly operating reports and a overall budget that I gave you the docket number for, which is again 1938. The information for that question can be found there, as well as what's called the monthly operating report of those debtors, which actually has the cash balances, et cetera. It's required by federal law. You can look there and you will see the cash available balances. How far is NRIA from going to normal business and come out of Chapter 11? I told you that answer already, and there isn't going to be really a normal business. Is the committee approving extension to file restructuring plan to June? The debtors, meaning the NRIA debtors, sought a longer extension of more than 120 days to file its plan. What that means is they wanted the exclusive period. When a company files for bankruptcy, only the debtors for the first 120 days can file a plan. Only they can. They have to move or ask the bankruptcy court for authority to extend that time so that no one else can file a plan. Under a provision of the bankruptcy code, the maximum period that can go is 18 months. And in this case, it's their first, I believe it's their first or second extension. And that extension is shorter than, because we said, no, we don't want the full 120, we want it shorter. So we gave them 90 days. And that 90 days is only an extent, doesn't mean that we gave them more time to file it. The goal is to file it as soon as possible. The extension is just to preserve that exclusive period while they file it. Why is that important? Because once exclusivity is lifted, it doesn't mean just the creditors or investors can file a plan. Any party in interest, including Salzano, can file a plan. That makes no sense. We want to protect it. They're working with us to file a plan jointly, and we'll do the best we can for you. What percentage of our investments are we likely to recover? As I mentioned, we do not know yet. Will there be a settlement with investors? That's a complex question, because there may be embedded within the plan an option for the creditors to, there may be, this is not firm, to join a settlement, which will enable them to participate in recoveries from litigation against third parties like banks and accounting firms. Otherwise, they may not be able to participate in those recoveries. So the idea here is there may be a provision, this is part of our discussions with the debtors, to include such a provision to recover against all these third parties. And that would include requiring the investors and creditors to join in that settlement to go after these people. Next, has the restructuring plan been published yet? I've answered that. And if you want to purchase a distressed asset from NRA's debtors, what is the process? The answer to that is there are individuals who at the company that are processing interest in the properties that third parties or investors may have. I would recommend that the person that asked that question individually email one of the Eismiller or Alvarez folks, and we will give you that contact information. Update on emergence from Chapter 11. We told you about that. When will we receive notice of status of our claims? I believe that is reference to claims being filed in the case and how those claims are going to be processed. And the answer is that claims process will take some time on the vetting of those claims. But we are building into the plan a possible structure that will potentially shortcut fights over reconciliation of the claims, delays about resolving the claims. So that settlement will, and that process within the plan would shortcut that. But no one's agreed to that yet, but that's what we're working on with the debtors to see if we can't structure something to avoid long and delayed process for resolving claims. The most important thing is that only true claims and true investors are paid. Will unsecured creditors in the fund receive their, quote, absolutely and unconditionally guaranteed 12% annualized preferred return? No, not likely. That is not that guaranteed return was what we currently believe to be part of the inducement for the Ponzi scheme. And that There is no current plan to provide a guaranteed return of 12% in any way going forward. It is a return out of the sale of the assets and the recoveries from litigation that the creditors will receive. The next and last one is the class action. Rosen Legal files class action lawsuits against NRIA and asks investors as lead plaintiffs. How do their lawsuits affect Chapter 11? Technically, those claims are outside the 11. They're being pursued in another court, apparently. Those lawsuits are, as we currently saw them, against certain individuals, by no means the full list that I gave you of what we're investigating, at least not right now. And that class action may, as we understand it from the Department of Justice, be the subject of a motion to stay that litigation by the Department of Justice. But that is not happened yet, but may occur. So that is the answer on the class action. It doesn't directly affect your distributions from this case, except to the extent that the recoveries or litigation there depletes assets available to pay creditors in this case against the same parties. That could theoretically, should that case get to a judgment and recover. Those are all the written questions. Let's go to the chat box for the last few minutes of this call and go through those questions. Alvarez, feel free to chip in when it is applicable, and Ice Miller team, feel free to do so as well. Will the December town hall meeting recording be posted? I believe, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, it has been posted and is on the website. Mike Ott, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it has been posted now, and it is available on the website for everybody to view.
Terrific. Thank you. Are these condo... Oh, wait, I skipped too far. Okay, the record... All right. Will there be a K-2 for 2022? We just talked about that. At the last meeting, you spoke repeatedly about your plan to make everyone whole. To what extent do you still believe you will accomplish this goal for the investors? I've covered that. The goal is and remains to get whole, but we are seeing a lesser value coming out of the real estate and a more important focus on asset recoveries to get to that 100% recovery number, the litigation recoveries. What total values of appraisals so far? We have those appraisals. We have total values. But because of the sensitive negotiation ongoing with respect to the plan right now with the debtors and the fact that we do not want to be deemed to be soliciting acceptances or dealing with the plan before a plan is filed, which is prohibited, we want to wait on those values until it's publicly available to disclose them to you. But we do have those appraisals. And as I mentioned, it is not looking like those values will cover the full amount of the investor claims. You mentioned that there are legal issues of the bankruptcy. Some properties aren't part of fund. I think that means NRIA is either project manager or minor shareholder. Is Ice Miller questioning whether NRIA has legal right to file bankruptcy? We've looked at the legal authority to file bankruptcy. That is something that we've looked at, but we certainly believe that the bankruptcy was filed in good faith. But we certainly would look at that closer before any plan is filed. Are these condos the only real estate that can bring money? No. There are other projects. There's the marina that Mr. Vaid mentioned. There are other units being in New York and in New Jersey being developed. There are other properties in Pennsylvania. So no, those are not the only condos. Only properties to create value. As questions are posted, the list moves. So I apologize as I have to relocate my last question. Oh, can you elaborate the difference between investors and creditors in general? Aren't the fund investors also creditors? Any exception? That is a partially, complex legal question, but essentially this case is a unique situation in the sense that there aren't a substantial number of general trade traditional creditors. There aren't $3 million, there aren't $50 to $100 million of trade creditors that might dilute the investor claims or cause some different treatment of the investor claims. Because as a matter of law, under a provision of the Bankruptcy Code called 510B, there is an there's a statutory subordination of investor claims or claims arising out of the sale of securities to trade creditors or other unsecured creditors that are allowed. If I'm saying that, Mike, if I'm saying it wrong, tell me, Mike, but I think I said it right. That basically is the law. Here,
Go ahead, Mike. I was going to say that is the law. Here, there aren't very many trade creditors at any of the entities. So really, the investors are, for all intents and purposes, you know, it in terms of the unsecured claims, whether they are treated as equity owners or creditors.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, there is a legal distinction, but in this case, it's a distinction without moment, if that makes any sense for you. Where can we find the total real estate inventory and updates on active construction? That I'll turn to Andrea and Hamir. I don't know if it's publicly available anywhere in terms of active construction, in terms of reports. But the real estate inventory is available in the sense on each schedule filed by the debtors that has the inventory of the real estate each debtor owns. But Andrea, I don't know if there's any other update on active construction that's publicly available.
Sure. So on the cash budget that you referenced earlier at the docket number, that will identify the current properties under construction. It'll have a couple buckets. It'll include those under construction and those that they own but haven't actually broke ground or are constructing currently. So that would be your best point of reference.
Thank you. There's a statement without a question. So I don't know, WABC radio reps, principals, et cetera. I think that was referring to the fact there are other people with potential promoting exposure. I understand that losses that result from a Ponzi scheme or other officially designated theft can be itemized as losses and deducted. What might this situation be designated as? I suppose we will have to wait until the dust entirely settles to know how much to deduct. That's correct. In the sense we don't know the number yet. And how that is treated as deductible is a separate tax issue you'll have to confer with your own tax advisor. EB-5 reps, government administration, NGOs, etc., possible cause of action. That is correct on some of those. We won't comment on everything, but certainly EB-5 reps in the sense of promoters fall within our look for investigation. And they are, I could give you names, but I won't do it now, but we do have those names. Will Mr. Casey be investigated? A few of us invested after he came on board. He knew there were problems when he joined, or why would they need him? Why didn't he stop taking investments at that point? I don't know how to address that without disclosing too much, but I would say your question is well stated. I'll just say that. Next question. And what I mean by that is it's a worthy question. How long would it take for all claims to be done? I mentioned that will take some time. It's a process. There are right now 5,700 plus claims filed. In the aggregate total of $4 billion in claims, that all has to be vetted. So that will take time. Is there a hope that any company would run NRA as a company, or are we dissolving the company? Like I mentioned, it will not formally legally be dissolved at confirmation for reasons I won't get into here, but the company will not continue as it was pre-bankruptcy. It's a different company after that. We already addressed the K-1s in 2022. How much is the estimated value of current owned real estate? We went through that. We went through some of these other questions. I want to make sure we don't. Okay. I mentioned that the pace we're on for restructuring. Have you collected enough evidence from some of the insider-related documents that you would enable the committee to apply to the bankruptcy court to freeze assets? The answer to that is we do not have standing at the current moment to bring any actions. The debtor has the standing to do so. We've been working with them to identify those assets, and the standard for freezing assets is a very high standard, but the answer is yes, we're working with them on that. Brian, Kartsotsian, it's a difficult name to pronounce, was main contact for most creditors, including myself. He expressed worry to me one time or more in his concern over the continuous expansion of the portfolio. Also pushed the frequent calls and emails to solicit more investment from me. All right, thank you for that information. It's not a question, so thank you. We are aware of that name and we know that person. I need to be clear on this issue. Are you saying that the value of NRA assets are not sufficient to provide a distribution to investors? How do you know that? What is the asset claim liability ratio? No, that is not what we're saying. We're saying that there isn't enough in value in assets to cover 100% of the amount of the investor claims. Not that there's not enough to pay any distribution, just not enough to pay 100% at this time of hard assets. And that's what was, as of the petition date, this is, we're not talking about after that. So that's, but we are working to get, you know, the full payout, but that's not a guarantee by any means. What is the appropriate gap between total assets and total liabilities? The total liabilities is part of the claims vetting process that requires that we review and explore and examine each of these claims and determine what the dollar amount is of true claims against the company. There could be claims there that we had never heard of or didn't know about or the debtor didn't know about. So we need to explore those to see what the true liabilities are. But based upon the books and records of the company, there is a material gap between the hard assets on hand and the total liabilities. And the reason why, again, I'm not giving you hard numbers is because I don't want to give you a number that you rely on and you tell the world is the hard number until the work and homework is done vetting those issues with the debtors and the analysis they did is vetted by Alvarez. But we have it's ongoing and it is very close to being done. And you will see those numbers and disclosures all in a disclosure statement in the near term. Please do your best to include all creditors in process to recover funds from third parties. Why wouldn't, I don't see any of the rest of the thing, it ended there. All creditors that
I think it continues on in the next written question right below.
Oh, okay.
Why wouldn't all creditors be included in third party recoveries?
They are. I mean, all allowed, meaning permissible and appropriate and correct claims that are not disallowed by the court, would share in recoveries from the estate that are recovered. Do you know what the claims objection noticing process will look like yet, or do you have a plan for same? That is being developed. It's going to probably be something done in conjunction with the trustee who will be appointed in the case, meaning the liquidating trustee. So that process is not formalized yet, but it will be eventually. The first step is making sure we have a plan. The plan maximizes recoveries. The disclosure discloses all the assets and liabilities and gives everyone their information adequate to vote on that plan. We get it confirmed. And as we get towards confirmation, we'll work towards that plan, that claim reconciliation process, and then it'll flow post confirmation probably. When do we expect some payout? I described that already. Any estimate of how much expenses will dilute capital, i.e. attorney's fees? We addressed that already. Any consolidated MRRs available? I'll ask Andrea and on that question. Consolidated MRRs, I'm not sure if there are any. I think they're all individually filed, although
That's correct, Lewis. They're all individually filed.
Does creditor committee have a right to change the company's management team? We certainly have the right to request it. It has been pared down significantly. And so if people don't know what the management is, right now the management is, there is a board appointed by the court at the very top of two retired bankruptcy judges, Judge Kevin Carey and Judge Kevin Gross. Then there's another individual who is a financial advisor, a long experience advisor within the financial world, who is the third member of the board. The board has its own counsel, which does very, you know, good work, outstanding lawyers, but they're not engaged actively in the bankruptcy process of the case. But then you have the debtor, and the debtor itself is run really right now by a CRO, Chief Restructuring Officer, named John Fioretti. And then there's this Chief Operating Officer, Rick Budd. And then there are there's the financial officer, Tommy Fierro, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And then there are a few other employees. There isn't enormous. They've reduced the staff down significantly for costs and expenses otherwise. So right now, and by the way, that came about because at the beginning of the case, we got Mr. Casey removed. Board was put in their place. Management then came in and reduced staff and ferreted out and vetted out some of the people who may have been still bad actors. So that's all been cut out. And so staff has been and the management has been reduced significantly. But to answer your question, generally, we have the authority as a committee to request that the court reconstitute management if that is in the best interest of the estate. When can we get real numbers? Weeks, months? I would say weeks. I would say probably realistically within 1 to 2 months, it will be publicly available. I would think 1 to 2 months.
The plan, when it is filed, will be accompanied by a disclosure statement that has to disclose basically all the, you know, how the plan works, what the expectations are in terms of recovery. So when the plan is filed, you should receive numbers, and we are hopeful to get that out as soon as possible.
Right. Next question is a good question. I'm going to lay it out for you in a way that I hope you understand is based upon these kinds of mass tort cases and how they're handled in a way that maximizes recovery for investors. Question is, when in the process do you begin actual litigation against employees and promoters, banks, advertisers, CNBC, Fox, etc.? And the answer to that is that the committee itself will hopefully have standing, meaning the authority, to bring these actions once that plan is confirmed and the trust is established. But before then, we have something that outside of bankruptcy, including in the class action, does not exist. We have. It's called Rule 2004 discovery. It means we can pursue investigations before we sue anybody. So think about that. We can depose and demand information for anything at all relating to NRIA and its business and its conduct and get that information by court order, examine it, and then with all that information armed with the data, pursue those claims. Meanwhile, most lawsuits require that you have some idea of the claims, believe you've been damaged, commence the lawsuit, and then get discovery. That's not what happens here. Under bankruptcy, we can do both. We do 2004, get huge amounts of information and discovery, take depositions like we'll be doing with U.S. Construction before we sue them. And then if we feel there are claims on behalf of the estate, once given the authority, we sue them. So the answer is, within a number of months, we hope to be able to sue the entities that may have culpability in connection with promoting the illegal sale of securities. For after Chapter 11 exited and the company goes into trust, if enough rental income generating properties exist, why couldn't the trust continue for years if it would mean 100% recovery? I know it may not be typical, but if gets us to 100% prior to sales, why not? This is the last question, by the way. And the answer is absolutely why not. If the financial numbers show that there would be rentals or value or income that would get you 100%, and we don't have to sue anybody to get you at 100%, the goal here is 100% to you, period, end of story. That's the only reason we exist, is 100% recovery to investors and creditors. That's our reason. And so if that gets you there, God bless it. Let's do it. So the answer is why not? But of course, having done too many of these, it doesn't always work that way. And so we may have to go after the bad guys. There may be a basis to go after them just for retribution, just to get the assets taken from them and get it back to you. Even if, you know, it's 110 cents on the dollar, if we can get that for interest on your claims. So let's see what we can do. Could you go over the class action lawsuit and what the advantage or disadvantage of a class action lawsuit versus bankruptcy proceeding? So let's talk about the class. I just mentioned the class action. I'm not sure I want to repeat it because that is a pending litigation. We want to do nothing that would interfere with that litigation. except to the extent it interferes with the bankruptcy case. We've heard from the Department of Justice that they are contemplating bringing an action to stay it because of the fact that there could be testimony in that case that would impair their criminal action against the individuals that are being sued there. But in terms of the bankruptcy itself, that is an action in terms of the class action outside of the bankruptcy, not connected to the bankruptcy. But if there's a recovery there, it could theoretically deplete recovery to the creditors who are here. Are you talking about 100% principal? We're trying to get to 100% of recoveries. And the only way you get interest is if there are assets and value in the estate beyond your principal. And we don't think that's realistic, but that is certainly what the law would say, but that's not realistic. If we get to 100% from asset value recovery, then we still sue them for breach of their 12% guarantee, right? Certainly, if there is 100% principal asset value recovery, which again is not currently forecast, but if we were to get there, and I wouldn't say the 12% guarantee, I would say interest, in the sense that if there are assets and value in excess of our claims, and that includes recoveries, then under the law, if there is value in the estate such that what is essentially means that the debtor is not insolvent because there's value in excess of the amount of the claims, and you would get an interest component to your claim theoretically. But again, chasing this money against third parties who are trying to hide it and are fraudsters is not only expensive, but also difficult to locate the assets and recover. We know that the real estate currently doesn't show that kind of recovery for you. So I would not bank on recoveries above principal. I wouldn't even bank necessarily right now that 100% of the principal will come out of the real estate. So we've got a long way ahead of us, and we're working hard to get that 100% recovery. Those are all the questions. I think anything else, there is one question, bear with me, that came by email. I did not have a chance to read it, but I do want to give that investor an answer, and to the extent it helps you, I would hope it would. So bear with me 1 second. Let's see if I can find it.
We have another question in the chat from Austin while you're looking for the email. How do we calculate claims in the bankruptcy process? What is the methodology? One of the things that Lewis mentioned earlier was we are in the midst of discussions with the debtors on certain legal issues with respect to the plan and certain features of the plan. And one of those questions that is open is, what is the appropriate way to value claims, to estimate and calculate claims, so that we have a consistent metric for every investor? We are working to try and figure out what is the most equitable way to do that. And, the committee is in discussions on that. And once that is decided, it'll be out in the plan, but everybody will be able to see it.
All right, great. So I won't read the whole question. It's a great question from this investor. But if you're on, I hope you can hear my answer. The question is, essentially, if we took a longer view of the case, if we took a perspective that some of these properties could be converted to rentals and there'd be an income stream and then eventually sell condos and generate revenue from the real estate over a longer term to get a greater recovery, A, would we explore that option? And B, it could be an option that generates greater recovery. It could. They're just speculating. If it could, would that be considered? And the answer is every option is being explored. Hamir is on for the real estate backdrop to what, Alvarez is doing in conjunction with the debtor. And every option along those lines is being considered. And anything that will maximize the recovery will be considered. But that is being done led by the CRO with his team of real estate advisors, as well as broker advisors and the board. And then we, as the committee through Alvarez, vet that real estate financial analysis and share our thoughts. So again, every option, including joint ventures with developers, such as one of which I saw just the other day as a consideration for one of the projects, all are being considered as options for maximizing your recovery. So good question and well said, I might add, but it is a valid option to consider. Any other questions? I think we're done, right? All right. All right. Thank you so much, everyone. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your time. I hope it was informative. And on behalf of all of us, we sincerely hope we get the best possible recovery for you. And thank you again.